Well, welcome again to this seventh in our current series of Darwin College lectures on the theme of Darwin. Last week, those of you who are regulars will recall we had a biogeographer talking about the extent to which the human species seem to be busy damaging the lives of other species by mucking up the planet. This week, we turn to the human species itself and to some extent, to what extent is it doing the same to itself? So adept have we become at preserving life and tinkering with it that it may be that we've rendered ourselves immune or exempt from Darwinian principles and the first species to do so. Is human evolution over? Well, the speaker tonight will be known to many people, is Steve Jones. He's a professor of genetics at University College London. He did his undergraduate and graduate training at Edinburgh University. And his heavy science has been done on genetic speciation in snails and fruit flies. But at least as important in terms of significance to the public understanding of science is his great contribution as a communicator of science and of its enthusiasms and paradoxes and polemics to the wider world. I have to say, having read almost like a whale some years back, his book where he revisited on the origin of species, looking at the significance of how it stood up in terms of modern science, I think we had him almost first on our list for the speakers for this year's series. We couldn't not have him. And since then, he's written a number of books on inheritance, on snails, on males, on coral. And one just come out on Darwin's Island, on other aspects of Darwin's work. Steve Jones has been a Rees lecturer. He's got the Faraday Medal. We really couldn't have a better person to talk to us about. Is human evolution over? You're very welcome.
Thank you for that. Let me do the traditional trying to find my lecture notes. Oh, there they are. Okay, good. I'm honoured indeed to be invited to this Darwin College series. I suppose we can call these the Darwin Squared lectures now, because they're Darwin College Darwin lectures. And I'm, of course, most curious to see Gwen Raverat's house, which was so important to the Darwin family. If you look back to the history of humans, the human opinion about the future of mankind, humankind, you can see that actually the notion that we are about to change goes back to long before Darwin. Long before modern biology. You can, of course, trace it to the Greeks. You can trace it to Plato with his men of gold, iron, and brass and the like, allegedly people of different quality, only some of whom should be allowed to reproduce themselves. You can trace it to medieval Japan, where there were frequent complaints that this generation was not like the last one and the next one was going to be even worse. Not much has changed, as we can tell. But we can trace it, perhaps in the British context, most directly to this famous book by Thomas More, Utopia, written in 1516. And if you, and More invented the word utopia, and the utopian word has become an important part of the English language. And there are various maps of utopia. Here's one of them. It looks alarming, like the Isle of Wight, which is not really what I would have described as a utopian place to live. The last time I was there, I was in Parkhurst Prison. I wasn't there for mass murder, but I was actually interviewing mass murderers. But that's another story. And if you read Thomas More's Utopia, which is a beautiful piece of English literature, it's really rather interesting. It does show a great change in society, without question. And there are a number of descendants of it, much more recently Samuel Butler's Erewhon, for example, all of which are really remarkably similar because they envisage a future in which human society has changed. Usually, it has to be said, for the better. In Erewhon, for example, we have chamber pots made of gold, People who commit crimes go to hospital because there must be something wrong with them. People who become ill go to prison because they haven't looked after each other, after themselves. And it's a place in which really the way we live has completely altered. However, about 100 years ago, that view of the future changed. It changed to a kind of model of this kind. Here's one of the infinite number of modern utopians, the infinite number of creatures, imagined creatures, by science fiction and the like, the people who live in the future. I think, I have to say, this is rather a snobby statement. I've never actually watched Star Trek, but I think this is a Star Trekian. And you can see he's undergone some rather interesting physical changes. He has, I think, probably fairly non-functional ears, but very impressive eyebrows, a rather crafty look, an alcoholic's nose, and that kind of stuff. And I could multiply that kind of image again and again to suggest that we would expect physical change in the future. But what's interesting is in the face of these mutated monsters, which people are now imagining are going to appear on Earth, society, the future society, hasn't changed at all. If your Star Trek has got tribes in it, and wars, and a bit of love interest, it's got servants and masters, it's got lots of weapons, it's got machinery. In fact, apart from the fact that some people have got peculiar ears, we might actually find ourselves rather at home there, were we to move into the future. So why was there this shift between a social model of the years to come and what's fundamentally an evolutionary or a biological model? I think we can trace it pretty directly to this chap here, photographed here, I have to say, at University College London. This is H.G. Wells. I can admit here that he was a graduate of Imperial College rather than UCL. I know, H.G. Wells trained as a biologist, and we all know he's a remarkable man. He really founded modern science fiction with the book, which I'm sure you've all read, published in the mid-1890s, called The Time Machine. And the plot of The Time Machine has become very familiar. It was a very novel plot at the time. What happens is that the hero develops a sort of machine, a kind of bicycle, which he bicycles off into the future, and the light blurs and things whirl past him and that kind of stuff. And he wakes up. He wakes up in somewhere, well, I suppose it's remarkably like Cambridge, really. It's full of, or perhaps it's more like Hampstead because it's a big city. And in this delightful utopian place, he discovers a race of men, a race of people called the Eloi, who live delightful lives, drinking tea, reading The Guardian, chatting politely to each other, and going to bed early. And just, in fact, like Cambridge. However, it turns out that, quite unlike Cambridge, there is a terrible, terrible secret. And the terrible secret is that lurking underground is a second race of humans called the Morlocks. And the Morlocks are brutish, nasty, and vile. And in the London context, I suppose, you would regard them as the inhabitants of Camden Town, where I happen to live, rather than the inhabitants of Hampstead. And as is indeed the case in London NW1 and NW3, the Morlocks, the lower races, climb up through this labyrinth of passageways to get to the high points where all the tea drinkers live, and they burgle their houses and they smash the windows of their cars. And in fact, they even kill them and eat them. And the logic behind this tale is actually that the human race has split into two distinct species. It has evolved into two separate forms of life, one of which is beautifully advanced and lovely, and the other of which is short, British, and nasty. Okay? And behind that's a good story. And, of course, H.G. Wells, not just being a storyteller, but being a very talented novelist, puts a spin on the tale. In the end, the spin is that actually the master race are the Morlocks. And these delightful Eloi are simply their sheep and cattle who they feed and they kill and eat for food. And the logic behind that is a scientific logic. It's an evolutionary logic. It's a logic which descends directly from Charles Darwin himself, which is that our future is going to be determined by our physical biology and not by the way in which we live. H.G. Wells was a great devotee of this chap here, Francis Galton. He often appeared on public platforms with Galton, as I'm sure I don't have to tell this audience. Galton was Darwin's cousin and the founder of the science, or the quasi-science, of eugenics. Now, he sometimes painted as the founder of human genetics. I think that's actually a little bit too kind to him. Galton was a remarkable man, and I'm sure most of the stories of Francis Galton are familiar to you. He was interested in human quality, and he was among the first people to carry out a scientific investigation of human quality. He measured strength, weight, height, that kind of stuff. We still have the little brass counting device, which he used to keep in the palm of his hand when he went to different British cities and score the beauty or otherwise of the local females on a 5-point scale from attractive to repulsive. He was the only person to have made a beauty map of the British Isles. The low point, you'll be glad to know, was in Aberdeen. And the high point was just outside Harrods, where Harrods now is. So not much has actually changed. And that, too, was part of his interest in human quality. It's easy to tell silly stories about Galton, but Galton was actually a very serious scientist. He was important in the history of statistics. He was, for example, the man who invented the word regression. He used it in a slightly different way, regression to the mean, in a sort of genetical kind of way. And he was also the man who drew the first statistical distribution of the kind we're now so familiar with. And that statistical distribution really encompasses the views both of the eugenicists and of the school of H.G. Wells. Here we've got Galton's diagram of racial ability, very politically incorrect, but it shows you the kind of way he thought. Ancient Greeks, pretty smart, but they're extinct, so that doesn't matter. The English on top, needless to say, obviously. Then the Asians, the Africans, the Australians. I showed this in Sydney the other week. I wasn't chased from the hall, but I had I did have a nervous moment or two. And the logic behind that, which of course is entirely foolish, the logic behind that is that there are indeed genetically distinct groups of human beings, some of whom are genetically overlapping in their abilities with animals. Behind that, again, was the fear that some groups were reproducing more effectively than others. You know, the Australians and the Africans, were doing better than the ancient Greeks and the English, and therefore there would be an inevitable decline in the human race. Well, maybe, is my response to that. I don't actually think that's true, I don't think, far from being a decline, I also don't think there'll be any improvement insofar as one can use that word. But that notion of Galton's comes directly from Charles Darwin. And indeed, the whole of modern science fiction comes from Charles Darwin, the notion that things will change and we will change to match them, very frequently in a way that the proponent of that particular view doesn't like. So let's remind ourselves what the theory of evolution actually is. If anybody here needs reminding, which I doubt, but I will do so to remind myself before I continue with the talk. Darwin's book, The Origin of Species, is, as we all know, is a most remarkable book. It's sometimes said that there are two kinds of science books. There's The Brief History of Time, and there's everything else. That isn't true. The Brief History of Time is impenetrable. The Origin of Species was written, of course, as a popular science book, and everything else in popular science, in science, pales by comparison. It sold out. It sold many, many copies. People talked enormously about it. Darwin really made quite a lot of money out of The Origin of Species. He was the first person to get an advance from a publisher, so he knew it was going to be successful. My books and most other popular writers' books have not been so successful. I found myself rather in brackets the other week giving a talk which I completely misread what I was supposed to be doing at St. Paul's Cathedral. And as ever, I didn't look at what I was supposed to be saying. And I was introduced to this large mass of people in the cathedral as Steve Jones, who was going to explain, why are we here? And I thought, oh, my God. And then I then had a moment of inspiration. I said, well, I know why I'm here. It's because you can't afford Richard Dawkins. And there are still some science books that sell enormous numbers. And for some reason, evolution books, just like The Origin of Species, sell far, far more than any others. As I said to my publishers, I don't mind if the millions of creationists, both in the United States and here, burn my books as long as they buy them first. But they don't do that. But people are very, very interested in evolutionary biology. It's an interesting subject, but they're interested in for reasons which I think are not justified. They're interested in evolution as a kind of key to the human race, as an understanding of themselves, perhaps an understanding of society. And I don't think that's true. So let's remind ourselves what a modest theory and what a simple theory Darwin's idea actually is. He defined it in three simple words: descent with modification. Descent, the passage of information from one generation to another. Modification, the fact that passage is imperfect. The idea, of course, is a very old one. You can see it in language, as Darwin himself points out in his writings. I think it was Diderot who said, English is but French badly pronounced, and English and French are clearly closely related languages. You can trace them back to a common ancestry about 1,500 or 2,000 years ago. English and my own native language, which is Welsh, go back much older, and you can make trees of language, which were made long before Darwin made but trees of biology. So that part of Darwin's idea is simple enough and old enough. We can rephrase it today as genetics plus time. If you've got genetics, the passage of information through DNA, its copying is imperfect, which of course it is through mutation, and if you've got time, 3,500 million years, evolution is both inevitable and simple. It is so simple, indeed, it could almost be physics. So that's what evolution is, and that idea was not new to Darwin. But what was new to Darwin, and was has been said to be the most clever idea anybody has ever had, I think that's probably a bit hyperbolic, but what was new to Darwin was his mechanism of natural selection. And what natural selection is, and I'll return to it in more detail in a moment, consists of inherited differences in the chances of reproducing. And that, as we'll see, is an extraordinarily powerful means of generating new forms of life. Darwin's theory nearly turns on differences, on inherited differences from one individual to another, on the accumulation of change, differences in the chances of reproduction, and random differences in the chances of passing on, finding mates and passing on genes in small and isolated populations. And I'll look at each of those three components together, one after the other, and I hope I'll suggest to you that Darwin's machine, simple as it is, has at least for the time being, and at least in the developed world, lost much of its power. At least its power to cause physical directional change in humans. Evolution to a geneticist or a biologist simply means a change, an alteration in gene frequencies over time, and that's certainly going on still. But the notion that sort of H.G. Wells' notion that we change into something different, I think is probably wrong. So let's look at the first part of Darwin's machine. The notion of difference. I remember in the 1960s. I remember in the 1960s when I started doing my brief, my sporadic interaction with molecular genetics. I worked with a chap in the University of Chicago, and came back to the Galton Lab in London, where I now work. And they were then beginning to discover inherited differences at the molecular level among people, looking at differences in proteins. It looks very simplistic to us now, but at the time it was quite astonishing, because the belief then was clearly that actually the most human populations were very homogeneous. There was hardly any difference from one person to another. Indeed, there might be a shortage of Darwin's raw material, which is difference. Well, the protein stuff made it clear that wasn't true. The early DNA stuff, and by that I mean the DNA stuff of 2005, made it clear that also wasn't true. And people soon began to say that it was clear that everybody in the world, apart from identical twins, was different from everybody else. Then it became obvious that everybody who ever has lived or ever will live is genetically different from everybody else. And with the recent 1,000 Genomes Project, which is to look at a huge number of different people to see how they vary from one site to another in the DNA, the astonishing fact has become obvious that every sperm and every egg made by every man and every woman who ever has lived or ever will live is different from all the others. So there's a fantastic amount of variation and difference out there. And of course, it all comes from mutation, from errors in copying DNA. So mutation is part of the Darwin machine. And I'll just ask briefly about the future of human mutation, because one of the persistent themes in these biological views of the future and these science fiction views of the years to come has to do with radiation and starbursts and chemicals in the water that are going to lead to new mutations and an inevitable decline in the human gene pool. Arguably, the most cynical scientific experiment ever carried out was done on August the 6th, 1945, when this is a picture of the bomb being dropped on the city of Hiroshima. 5 or 6 days later, a second bomb was dropped on Nagasaki, and a few days after that, the Emperor of Japan made his first broadcast to his people, proved himself to be a master party political broadcast, because he said, "Fellow Japanese, the war is developing in a direction not necessarily to our advantage." In other words, we give up, we surrender, we've lost. And thank goodness, of course, they did, and the war came to an end. Waiting in the wings were two teams of scientists who were sent very quickly into the two cities, one of which was a team of physicists who wanted to look at the amount of damage done, and they were astonished by the power of the bombs, but also there was a team of geneticists who were strongly of the opinion that they would find not only that the people exposed to the radiation would suffer damage, but of course they did, many of them, very severe damage, not only that those exposed would suffer damage to their DNA and their cells, but their children would. And in fact, the Radiation Effects Research Foundation, as it became known, stayed in Hiroshima from early 1946 to about 2005. So they stayed for more than 50 years. Now, at the beginning, really, it was we now know, with the benefit of hindsight, it was a waste of time because we didn't have the technology to find human mutations. But they plugged away, and by the end of their research, the DNA technology was available. They looked at millions and millions of individual genes in two groups of people, children whose parents had been within a short distance of the explosion site and children whose parents had been considerably further away. Their expectation that the explosion itself would have caused mutation was simply wrong. There was no difference in frequency between the two. They did find, though, 28 different mutations, 28 DNA changes in a child compared to its parents. 25 of those 28 were in the father rather than the mother. And now we know, indeed, that far more potent as a mutagen than the hydrogen bomb is the male. Most mutations, at least most of a large class of mutations, take place in men rather than in women. And that's due to a rather simple difference in the way that men and women make their sex cells. Women, of course, make their eggs before they're born. They then release them at intervals throughout their reproductive lives. Men, I can assure you, never rest. We make sperm all the time, even the Darwin College, Cambridge. And as a result, there are many more cell divisions from the sperm that made a man to the sperm that he passes on compared to the egg that makes a woman compared to the egg that she passes on. Indeed, from egg to egg, on the average, there are about 24 divisions of cells. Every time there's a cell division in a cell line, of course, there's a chance of an error, a mutation. But from sperm to sperm, there are many, many more. For a 28-year-old father, which is the mean age of reproduction in Europe as a whole, that's East and West included, there are about 300 cell divisions. For an older father, there are many more. And it's been known for some considerable time that actually mutation rate goes up quite strongly with the age of fathers. Here we've got a Velázquez painting of a guy called Mari Barbolo, who was a dwarf in the Spanish court. A chondroplasia, which often arises by new mutation, usually arises by new mutation, the rate of mutation goes up from 24-year-old fathers to 50-year-old fathers by about three times. If you go down to 16-year-old fathers versus 70-year-old fathers, that curve steepens considerably, and the rate goes up by about 10 times. And the same is true for a great variety of different genes. So actually the dangerous mutagens are older fathers. And in fact, Darwin himself was an old father. His last child was born when he was well over 40, in his 50s indeed. And that, of course, historically was quite common. So what then is happening to the age of parents? What's actually happening is slightly unexpected. And it may have an effect, on the human mutation rate. Certainly, the mean age of both fathers and mothers in Europe, this is Western Europe, has gone up slowly over the last 20 or 30 years. For fathers in Western Europe, as apart from Europe as a whole, it's about 33, going up to 34 or so. So that's going up, but that's happening, of course, because people are delaying the start of their families for social reasons, through late marriage, contraception and the like. But what's also happening, we may start late, but we finish early. People no longer carry on, as they once did, reproducing until they're biologically unable to do so. Women, of course, are forced to cease reproduction at menopause. Men, in principle at least, if they can find somebody to collaborate with them, can continue reproducing as long as, to make rather a vulgar analogy, they can continue reproducing as long as they can keep it up. And the figures are actually rather surprising. The proportion of older fathers, or the proportion of children born to older fathers, if you compare the underdeveloped world with the developing world and the developed world, are quite strikingly different. In Cameroon, for example, here we've got something like half of all children are born to fathers over 40. in Pakistan, which is a rather more developed nation, something like, I suppose, one in four of all children are born to fathers of over 40, 45 or so. And in France, which of course is the most developed nation of all, only about one in 20 children are born to fathers over about 45. So the incidence of older fathers, who are the main mutagens, is going down. So far from any hint that the rate of human mutation will increase, in the future, it'll probably decrease, at least for the time being. I have to say, I don't really think that the human evolution is limited by mutation, but at least it suggests that common fear that we're going to go into some kind of DNA damage meltdown is wrong. So that's mutation. That's the first part of Darwin's theory. What about the central part, natural selection? I often think of natural selection as a factory for making almost impossible things. And of course, it's a standard claim by creationists that if something as complicated as the eye or the knee or the elbow or the fingernail couldn't possibly have evolved by any kind of mechanism, there must have been some kind of designer out there. And that's entirely foolish, as I hope, I expect most of us agree. But many people don't actually realize the extraordinary power of Darwin's machine to do just that, to make almost impossible things. Everybody in this room is an almost impossible thing. Some of us arguably a bit more impossible than others. The bacteria in your guts, of which there are 10 times as many in cellular terms as there are cells in your own body, simple as they are almost impossible things. So where have they come from? Strangely enough, my own first exposure, well, I didn't realize it at the time, to the power of natural selection came in a factory. It actually came in a soap factory. I made the possibly unwise decision to leave school at 16, which I did, and I started training as an engineer, an apprentice fitter rather than an engineer, in the Unilever factory in Merseyside, Liverpool's left bank in the Wirral Peninsula. And I worked in the detergent shed. And the way you make detergents, then as now, was to take a gigantic vat of boiling chemical liquid at high pressure and to squirt it through a nozzle. And the liquid came zooming out and broke into two phases, a vapor, which was carried away by fans and recycled, and powder, which is the detergent itself. And powder falls into vats, and that's the stuff you're trying to sell. Well, in my day, the nozzles look like this. They're about 6 feet long, made of stainless steel, small hole in the middle. Very expensive, very heavy, and they were a damn nuisance. They were always clogging up. You had to take them out and unclog them. They were very inefficient. They made grains of different sizes. They were very sensitive to the exact chemical constitution of what was going into them. They wouldn't make anything. They'd just spray out water, spray out liquid if that was wrong. So they were very far from being ideal. So the factory owners, not just in Unilever but in many other places, put a lot of money into hiring intelligent designers, mathematicians and physicists, to improve these things. And they had a limited amount of success. But it was very limited because the physics of turning a liquid into a powder plus a vapor, a phase transition, is really quite difficult and hard to model, and it's hard to improve what's going on. So I think probably without realizing it, these people turned to a classic example of natural selection, of Darwin's machine, of inherited differences in the chances of reproduction. What was done was to take the nozzle, to make 10 copies changed, mutated at random. Longer, shorter, bigger or smaller hole, different angle of attack, maybe some grooves on the inside. Test those 10. Possibly one was marginally a few parts of a percent better than the one that had gone before. If you took that, changed it absolutely at random again, and repeated the process, basically as a sort of physical analog of the process of Darwin's natural selection. And as you can see, and this is a rather primitive model, what genuinely did happen, very quickly you began to see some remarkable changes without, of course, any implication that a designer had been involved. In mold. 45 generations later, this is what we've got. This is an almost impossible nozzle. Nobody designed it. Nobody could have designed it. Nobody knows why it works, but it works 100 times better than what went before. It's not beautiful, it's downright ugly. It's perhaps not quite as ugly as the eye, which is a totally chaotic structure, but it's quite astounding. And this is after 45 generations. When we think that even in terms of modern humans, we've got tens of thousands of generations to play with, it's clear that natural selection is an extraordinarily powerful agent. Many people suggest that natural selection simply couldn't work on humans. I'm suggesting maybe it will not, but it's certainly not the case that it has not worked on humans. Let me take a slight divergence just to show the power of what selection, Darwin's machine, can do to us within our own relatively recent history. The human species is, you know, it's a primate, Darwinian man, though well-behaved, is really but a monkey shaved, as Gilbert and Sullivan had it. But it's not like most primates. First of all, it's very widespread, unlike most primates, and we'll come back to that. And secondly, it's very variable from place to place. If one's being frank about the Galtonian view of race, it makes, at first sight, a certain amount of sense. It is the case that people in Africa tend to be black and people in Europe tend to be white. And if they were different dogs, let's say, or different kinds of mice, we might regard them as distinct species, or at least very, very different subspecies. That isn't actually true. The amount of difference genetically as a whole between Africa and the rest of the world is very, very small, with the exception, of course, of skin color itself. And if we draw a map, as we all know, of skin color across the globe, you get this striking association between skin color and position. Well, there have been many theories as to why that should be. There's the biblical theory that I think it was Japhet, one of Noah's sons. No, it's Ham, one of Noah's sons who saw his father naked. It was a terrible sin in those days because Noah happened to be drunk at the time. And so all his offspring were condemned to be black. And there are many other theories which are almost as absurd. But now I think we know at least part of the answer. And the answer, I'm sure some of you, of course, are aware of it, is slightly surprising. What's odd about the dark melanin pigment in the skin, which everybody has, but some peoples have more than others, is that everything we know about it is good. If you've got black skin, you're much safer against skin cancer than if you don't have black skin. And skin cancer is really quite a killer. I've just been in Australia, and people's behavior have changed a lot in the last 20 years because of the epidemic of skin cancer. The incidence of skin cancer in the world is highest in Australia, second highest in Ireland. Now, Ireland isn't famous for its hot, sunny days, but it is famous, and we'll come back to this, for almost transparently fair skin and red hair of its people. A great lack of melanin. So there are other good things that melanin does. If you sunbathe, you lose a lot of antibodies. The protective proteins in the blood are broken down by the ultraviolet light. If you've got light skin, it gets into your body and breaks it down. And that really is quite a big effect. For pregnant women, the ultraviolet light, if you're light in color, breaks down folic acid, which is a vitamin which is essential to have a pregnancy. Indeed, black skin ages much less than white skin when exposed to the sun. So everything we can see about dark skin, melanin, is good, except for one crucial point. And that is that the skin is the major source of synthesis of another vitamin, of vitamin D. Now, we all know about vitamin D. Vitamin D is traditionally known as the vitamin which prevents rickets. And in fact, most people's vitamin D historically has come not from food, but from exposure to sunlight. And if you've got light skin, you are much, much more efficient at making vitamin D than if you've got dark skin. We actually know the genes involved in skin color variation. This is a classic example of Darwinian thinking, although perhaps the people who did it didn't realize that. Darwin was, of course, a great comparative anatomist in his day. Modern molecular biologists are also great comparative anatomists. They've got a lot more money, but what they do is exactly the same as what Darwin did when he looked at barnacles, let's say, or cut up birds. They compare genes in different species. This is a fish known as the zebrafish, which is much used in developmental biology. It doesn't show up tremendously well on this slide. If you see them, it's more striking. But there's a mutation called Golden, which lacks the melanin pigment in those stripes. The gene was tracked down, ways I won't bore you with, and then, of course, you can simply search the human genome with a computer database, and the gene was found there, exactly the same gene. It's involved in the factory that makes melanin, and it's one of the steps in the factory that makes melanin, and it comes in two different forms. Here's form one and form two. Let's just look at Africa and Europe here. The African form is shown as blue, the European form as yellow. And in fact, there's only a one amino acid difference, a one building block difference in the two, in the proteins made in Africa and made in Europe. But this is the most geographically structured gene that we know in the human species. Something like 98 or 99% of all Africans have got one form, and something like 99% of all Europeans have got another form. So something pretty powerful must have happened to change some powerful natural selection must have taken place to favour the European form as we moved away from Africa 80, perhaps 100,000 years ago and into the cool and cloudy climates of the north. There's an interesting spin on that. If you look at now at China and Japan, where people have relatively light skin, they don't have the European form, the yellow form of the gene. They have the African form. But what's actually happened there is that they've evolved their relatively light skin by damaging or altering another step in the melanin production line. So that, in fact, light skin evolved at least twice. The West African form is the ancestral one, and East Asian and North European forms evolved separately as humans moved west and then east out of Africa. So whatever it was must have been pretty powerful. It acted pretty hard, and it picked up the nozzle story. It picked up whatever mutation became available. Well, as I said, it's pretty clear this has to do with vitamin balance. If you don't have vitamin D, you tend to get rickets. If you look in the cemeteries of London in Darwin's time, you find that half the children who died showed signs of rickets. So it was a very common disease, a shortage of decent food, the window tax, people's windows were closed up, they had very little sunshine because of the smoky environment, so they got rickets. There's a common feeling that rickets somehow has gone away, that it's a historical relic. That's simply not true. Rickets is still the second most common non-communicable disease among children. So it's common worldwide. People often think, well, rickets is the soft bone, vitamin D deficiency is the soft bone disease. But actually, we now know that vitamin D deficiency is harmful to health in many other ways. It greatly increases the incidence of multiple sclerosis, for example. It's said to make cancer more likely to become malignant and various other things. There's even the rather radical notion that's come out recently that actually part of the terrible health of the people of Glasgow. And let's remind ourselves, the average life expectancy of parts of Glasgow is 10 years less than the average life expectancy in a city like Cambridge. Part of their terrible health may be due to the fact we have gloomy grey skies and a shortage of vitamin D, as well as the deep-fried Mars bars and the refusal to leave the pub at any moment. And there's a real suggestion that we should maybe be supplementing northern people's foods with vitamin D more than we do those in the south. The effect of skin colour is quite striking. Here we've got plasma levels of vitamin D in European Americans with dotted lines and African Americans over the course of a year. And you can see that throughout the year, in the summer more than the winter, European Americans have got more than twice as much vitamin D on the average as African Americans. And the same is true in Britain. Less true in Britain because tend to be food supplements of vitamin D quite often. But one group in Britain is very much at risk, which tend to be young and older Islamic women who tend to cover themselves, not to go out very much, and often have rather a poor diet as well. And there are real signs of vitamin D deficiency there. So that's pretty clear is what drove light skin colour as humankind moved across the world, really quite quickly, within a few tens or 20 or 30 or perhaps a bit more thousands of years. That's natural selection in action within our quite reasonably recent past. In the last few months, there's a little twiddle on that tail which shows just how powerful this selection really can be. There's one very strange mutation in human populations which is only really historically found in Northern Europe. Here we have an example of it. Galton's fear of low IQ is obviously... this is the blonde mutation, okay? Now, the blonde mutation in some ways represents the extreme of skin and hair lightening. And blonde and pale red hair are much the same. The blonde mutation, until not long ago, was really common only in northern Europe. Now, why should that be? I mean, you know, the blondes were only found within 1,000 kilometres or so of somewhere like Copenhagen. They're not found in southern Europe, scarcely at all. They certainly aren't found in Turkey. Why is that? Well, it has to do with the spread of farming. To grow crops, grain crops, which is, of course, what the early farmers largely did, you need to have a warm spring. they need a warm spring to allow the seeds to germinate and the crop to grow. And almost everywhere in the world, that means you have to have a sunny spring. And nowhere in the world, with one exception, can you grow primitive forms of grain north of a line that passes, roughly speaking, through London. The exception is, of course, Western Europe, because in spite of the fact that we've got gloomy, grisly spring weather with no sun, endless cloud and rain, we have the Gulf Stream. So as a result, we can indeed grow grain crops. So this is actually a lethal combination. As farming spread in this sunless environment of the west of Ireland and Scandinavia and the like, as farming spread, people's diet shifted to this almost monoculture of muesli. They ate muesli every day. Well, I eat muesli every day, but I eat other things as well. They ate nothing but grain. Grain has got no vitamin D in it. And even worse, some grain crops can actually adsorb and suck up vitamin D, which you might take up from other foods. So any mutation which further lightened the skin and further allowed even more ultraviolet in would be favoured. This is a rather crappy slide, I fear. I couldn't find a better one. I'm sure there are better ones around. This shows the spread of cereal crops across Europe. And you can see, you know, muesli only reached Birmingham about 3,800 years ago. And it got into Scandinavia about 2,500 years ago. And in fact, grain farming really only got to the north of Scandinavia about 1,500 or 1,000 years ago. So this mutation actually may have emerged and spread within the past few hundred or at least a couple of thousand years, which again, in evolutionary terms, is very, very fast. So it certainly works. There's no question of that whatsoever. So what's going to happen to it in general? Let's remind ourselves what natural selection is: inherited differences in the chances of passing on genes. And once again, the crucial point, the crucial word, is differences. Okay? Let me explore that a little bit. When I start my first year lectures in genetics at UCL, and I've just given them, I hate to admit, for the 38th time, but that's another story. I'll actually start by saying I'm a geneticist, and my job is to make sex boring. And the students look blankly at me, but after 25 lectures, they sure as hell agree. But then I say, to cheer them up even more, then I say, look to the person to your left and the person to your right. And you might like to do that. You see, we get the same bemused sound from the first year students. And I tell them quite accurately, reasonably accurately, it's a rather muddy statement, I tell them reasonably accurately that 2 out of every 3 of them will die for reasons connected to the genes they carry. And that's, of course, true, because what kills us off now are cancer, heart disease, diabetes, and so on, all of which have got a strong inherited component. Now, I know that's a murky statement, but it gives you a general picture of what's going to happen. I cheer them up then by saying, OK, don't worry, cheer up, because if I'd been giving this lecture in Shakespeare's time, 2 out of 3 of you would be dead already. And that's true. That's perfectly true. These are the patterns of survival of children in England in 1601, roughly speaking, Shakespeare's time. About 1 in 3 lasted to be 21. In Darwin's time, and Darwin 1809, something like half of all children made it to be 21. And 3 of Darwin's 10 children, of course, died. That was by no means uncommon. But in 2001, 99% of all British babies make it to be of reproductive age, 21 years old. And the crucial thing, of course, is difference. If everybody stays alive, there's no raw material for natural selection on survival. You don't have to argue about why people die or how natural selection might have worked. It might have worked through vitamin D deficiency, it might have worked through infection, what have you. The fact that everybody stays alive, at least until they're sexually mature, means it's got nothing to work with. So the actual raw material of Darwin's machine, in terms of survival at least, is no longer with us. So that part of the Darwinian fuel has gone. Darwinism has no longer has death, much death, to play with. Of course, natural selection is a bit like the driving test. It's a two-paper exam. The first paper, the written paper, is easy, but then you have to pass the practical. And in terms of biology, of course, that means finding a mate and having children. And I have to tell you, I got through the first paper by definition because I'm still here, but I failed the practical because my wife and I have got no children. So from evolution's point of view, I may more or less, I might just as well be dead, okay? A cheery thought. And that, in fact, is a huge amount of natural selection, as Darwin himself realized in the Descent of Man and Selection in Relation to Sex book. There's a huge amount of natural selection that acts through the differences in sexual success rather than in survival. Now, as Darwin was the first to point out, the opportunity for that kind of selection, generally speaking, in most species, acts much more on the male than on the female, because the number of children that women can have is limited by the simple facts of biology. If you turn to that fount of scientific truth, which is the Guinness Book of World Records, they've got a lady in there who claims to have had 37 children. That does seem rather a lot, but I suppose it's just about possible. But certainly that would be a very exceptional number. When I was writing an earlier book of mine, I was trying to dig out figures on men. Of course, for men, the figure's potentially much greater because they're only limited by the number of mates they can persuade to have sex with them. And I found this chap called Moulay Ismail the Cruel of Morocco. And Moulay Ismail the Cruel admitted to having had 888 children. Some people accused him of having it more, but he always stoutly denied them. Now, of course, there was more than one Mrs. Moulay Ismail the Cruel. There may well have been 100, perhaps 150 of them, which meant in turn that there were 99 or 149 Moulay Abdul the Depressed, okay, men who did not succeed in finding a mate. If one man monopolizes all the females, then the other men, by definition, don't get any, and their genes don't pass on. And any difference in the ability to attract and sustain a female and to reproduce, which has any genetic basis, is very, very powerful evidence, very, very powerful fuel, potentially at least, for natural selection, as Darwin himself saw. Now, these patterns of extreme difference in sexual success have, generally speaking, gone away. They haven't gone away entirely. Here's a picture of a family on holiday in Sweden. You probably read that this picture was taken in the mid-1960s, as you can see from the rather unfortunate flared jeans there. The chap with a red ring around his head is Osama bin Laden. Okay? He's changed a bit since those days. And everybody around him is either his brother, his sister, his half-brother, or his half-sister. And Mohammed bin Laden, Osama's father, had 22 wives and 53 children. And we're talking only, indeed, in Mohammed, in Osama's own year of birth, Mohammed had 6 children. Osama bin Laden himself had, last time they were counted, 5 wives and 22 children. So in the Middle East then, and to a degree still today, you do have this pattern of some males with massive success, which means many males with no success at all. And that also has been true locally in many parts of the world. The Y chromosome, of course, is the signifier of male history. Every male has got a Y chromosome, which is passed down just like a surname from father to son. Y chromosomes are fairly variable. They change quite rapidly, and we can make maps of Y chromosomes, look at differences of them on them, and work out patterns of relatedness, shared male ancestry among any group of men. And generally speaking, greatly to oversimplify the story, if you take a bunch of males from some random place in France, let's say, or in the south of England, they're pretty different from each other. There tend to be many, many different kinds of Y chromosomes, showing no particular great shared male ancestry. One exception to that is found in Ireland. And in Ireland, one particular Y chromosome is at a frequency of as high as 1 in 6 in the north of Ireland. It's particularly common in families whose surnames, like O'Donnell, have long been regarded as proving descent from the High Kings of Ireland. And the High Kings of Ireland, who ruled the whole island of Ireland for many centuries, were really a bunch of warlords who I suppose one has to say, like many aristocrats of those days, who really brutalized their population. They had many wives, had many, many children. All of those High Kings of Ireland trace their ancestry from a kind of 5th century Bin Laden figure, a guy called Niall of the 9 Hostages, who had the gall to take St. David hostage even. Niall of the 9 Hostages, this is probably Niall of the 9 Hostages' Y chromosome, which is still there and reflects the massive differences in sexual success which persisted for centuries in that part of the world. And again, any of those differences that had genes behind them, perhaps genes for brutality or cunning, possibly, or charm, even if it comes to finding a mate, will be favored, whereas other genes would disappear. So there's been plenty of sexual selection and natural selection in humans. Now, what you can do with those data is put the figures on on what's available for Darwin to work on, to put them into a statistic that's called the opportunity for selection. And that puts together differences. Okay, now that pattern was very, very common until recently. What's clearly the case is it's no longer there, almost nowhere. What we generally find now is that every man and every woman has 0, 1, 2, or 3 children, unless you happen to be Mohammed bin Laden. And that change has happened very quickly all over Europe. Here's a pattern of fertility across Europe from 1880 to 2000, and it's rather, I won't go into it in detail. What you can see is that mean fertility has gone down, but that doesn't matter. The average number of children doesn't matter. If everybody had 16 children, there would be no natural selection. If everybody had 2 children, there'd be no natural selection. What matters is the variance, the variability, and you can see that huge spread that we had between countries and even more between families in 1900 has almost disappeared in the year 2000. So this process is no, just like survival, that process has almost disappeared. You can put those two figures together into this thing called the opportunity for selection, which puts together differences in survival and differences in reproductive success into a single figure. And if you take the data for Western Europe from about 1500 to today, the opportunity for natural selection, the raw material for Darwin's factory, the fuel of Darwin's factory, has gone down by more than 90%. So it's a good, very good case to be made that at least for the time being, at least in the Western world, Darwin's main mechanism has lost its power. Let me end up briefly by talking about the other the final part of the Darwin machine. Many people imagine Charles Darwin having spent many years sitting on the Galapagos studying his finches. Of course, that's entirely untrue. He only spent 5 weeks of the 5-year Beagle voyage on the Galapagos, and only part of that time on shore. He wasn't interested in the finches. They weren't called Darwin's finches until the 1950s. He did make some observations that suggested to him that something strange was going on, and my favourite one is he was marooned on 2 separate islands and killed and ate some of the giant tortoises, and he noted that on the island of Albemarle, the tortoises were smaller, blacker, and tasted sweeter when cooked than on the island of St. James. It's a very rare combination of science, of taxonomy and gastronomy there. But he found differences, and he found the mockingbirds were slightly different. And he particularly found that the plants and animals on the islands, more than isolated as those places were distinct from the mainland, the South American mainland nearby. And that really, I think, did plant some kind of seed about evolution in his mind. And it's striking that that seed was at least partly planted in isolated populations. And of course, humans once used to live in isolated populations. One of the things which is extremely characteristic to us as primates is how common we are. And that's new. I won't go into the full argument, but one of the ways you can work out what the historical population size of a particular species is, how many individuals there have been over long periods of time, is to ask how much genetic variation is there in that species. And the argument, and it's got a lot of assumptions in it, the argument is that species which have got lots and lots of genetic variation in them have probably, for most of the time, been very abundant because they allow those genes to persist without randomly losing them. Species with almost no genetic variation within them either are now or have been in the past rare. And the startling thing is that if we compare ourselves with chimps and gorillas, where we were the rare primate. Chimps and gorillas, for most of history, were common and abundant and present in large numbers. We were present in tiny numbers. We were a small group of hunter-gatherers, possibly on the African savannah, for much of our past. And the effect is quite startling. One of the great breakthroughs made by the science of ecology in the last 20 years is to discover that there are more mice than there are elephants. Okay, and I put that rather laconically, being kind of an ecologist and wondering what the science is really all about. But what you can do is you can draw graphs of the abundance of a particular mammal versus its body mass. And if you do the right kinds of transformations, you get more or less a straight line. Lots and lots of mice, fewer deer, fewer elephants, fewer still blue whales. Everything fits, apart from, guess who? Homo sapiens, which is about 10,000 times more common than it ought to be, in inverted commas, if we were just another primate. The natural population of the world, if we were just another primate, is not 6,000 million. It's something like the population of East Anglia, Cambridge included. Whether or not that would be an improvement, I simply don't know. Okay. The facts are quite startling. Every one of you on the way to this lecture saw more people than the average human being, by which I mean the average hunter-gatherer, is likely to have seen during his or her entire lifetime. So we've become extraordinarily abundant. And that's had a really a big effect. What was a series of islands has been reunited. I was in Australia the other week, and I saw a T-shirt which said, "Reunite Gondwana Land." Okay, and Gondwana Land, of course, was this gigantic continent which broke up to form Australia and South America and various things. And we've done that ourselves, not by geology, but with the petrol engine. We've actually moved from continent to continent, from village to village. Now we're a great mass, we're a great South America people, rather than little isolated population groups on island, on real or metaphorical islands. The history of ourselves as being rare has had a striking effect in many different ways. This is a slightly technical thing. Average percent heterozygosity is simply a statement of how diverse genetically different populations are. And we start off with various African groups, the Biaka and Mbuti. We go to a Middle Eastern group, the Druze, and then Europeans, Chinese, Japanese, and all the way to Serui at the southern tip of South America. And that really follows the track of human movement from Africa around through Siberia, across the Bering Land Bridge, and down through the Americas. And as you can see, as we do that, there's a pretty consistent drop in the amount of variation. That shows that we lived in small groups, went through population bottlenecks as we moved, and lost genetic variation as we did. The first person to notice the power of that effect was actually Francis Galton himself. And Galton, who was a relatively rich man, had the habit of going on holiday to northern Italy, the mountains of northern Italy. And he went there one year, prepare yourself for a crushingly awful joke, turned up in this mountain village with his wife, settled in there, noticed something very strange. Everybody in that village had the same surname, Spaghetti, shall we say. Told you it was an awful joke. He then climbed over the mountains to the next village, 20 miles away, noticed the same thing. Everybody in that village had the same surname, but this time it was Cannelloni. Next village, Pasta, so on and so on. Glad nobody laughed. They are terrible jokes. And Galton was very interested in this because he was very concerned about human quality, as I said. And he thought, well, maybe for some reason it's advantageous to be called Spaghetti in village one and Cannelloni in village two. But being a clever guy as he was, he realized that actually what was happening was random change in small island populations. If you go into the records, it turns out that each of these villages 500 or 600 years ago, to simplify matters, was founded by a group of 10 families with different names. They stayed there, and over time, inevitably, one male might have had no sons, might have had only daughters and no children. Then his name would disappear, because the name, like the Y chromosome, goes down the male line. So the other names would become more common, and inevitably, at the end of the period, all names but one would disappear, and one at random would remain. Everybody with a Y chromosome and that name would have the same Y chromosome, and everybody, male or female, would share an awful lot of their genes from that descendant, that ancestral Mr. Spaghetti, long ago. So that's what random change can do quite quickly, random genetic drift, as it's called. Surnames, of course, are inherited like genes, and that much as Darwin himself saw when he tried to work out mating patterns in humans using surnames. So that's what small population size can actually do. It can lead to quick change. You might think that it's gone away. Certainly, we're moving around much more than we did, but it's had an effect until very recently in Europe. Here's a picture I took about 10 years ago, more now, 12 years ago, in Finland, of a young girl with a rather nasty inherited nervous disease called variant late infantile neurolipofuscoidosis. No, it isn't going to be in the exam, as I always tell kids. It's a bit like Tay-Sachs disease or Batten's disease. It's a nervous degenerative disease. It's inherited. You need two copies of the variant gene in order to manifest it. And it's sad but true that that child will now certainly be dead because the infants with the illness very rarely survive more than a few years old. Finland, it transpires, has got at least 30 such genes which are found nowhere else in the world. And they're also within Finland, they're also very patchily distributed. There's that particular gene. Finland has the most extraordinarily complete collection of family records. And if you look at that, the family we've just looked at, if you look at the bottom there, as I'm sure you can read, from top to bottom are the generations, the circles are women, the squares are males, and people blacked in suffer from the condition. You can see that young lady who's the circle at the bottom. In fact, both her parents descend, often through several different paths through history, from one bloke at the top who lived in the 1650s or so. Okay? He must have carried a single copy of that gene, which he knew nothing about, which was passed down through the generations. There's another group A, which we can't link to that chap, but it's almost certain that every case in Finland descends from that guy. And that family is very, very inbred, as we say. They married relatives, often knew it time and time again. Darwin was concerned that he'd married his cousin. And Darwin, actually, being a great genius, used surnames to measure the incidence of cousin marriage. He worked out that if two people of the same name married, they were likely to be related, and he tried to work out inbreeding patterns in Britain from that. Inbreeding in Britain has historically actually been rather low. But certainly Finland, until not long ago, really was a series of islands of people in a sea of trees. And as a result, they changed genetically from place to place, not just in disease genes, but in every gene as well. So that pattern was really quite powerful in many parts of the world until today. Well, as geneticists say, history is made in bed, okay? That's certainly true, but now the beds are getting much closer together. People are bed hopping much more than they were. What's actually happening is that people are beginning to move. Their genes are moving, their names are moving, and their cultures are moving. Here's an example of this. Here we see the family Jones locked away behind the security fence in 1881. I was born in West Wales there, and here we see that in 1998, they haven't quite made it to Cambridge, but we're on the way, as you can see. And that, of course, is common for many, many surnames across Britain, and it's equally common for genes. Britain, of course, Cambridge today, certainly London today, is a very, very different city from what Darwin saw. It's a much more genetically open city. I'm rather proud of the fact that Britain is arguably the genetically sexually most open nation in the world in terms of marriage of people of different ancestry. There are many things that can predict the person you're likely to marry. Educational level is the best one. Neck size, collar size is actually quite effective too. Very good courtship strategy, I recommend. Firm but polite. And in some places, skin color is also very, very important. In Britain, though, skin color comes in at number 6. They are much more likely to marry somebody, if you're a European, to marry somebody of Afro-Caribbean origin if they have a PhD and you have a PhD, than you are to marry a European person who hasn't got any O-levels. So we are really open, which means that the genes are actually mixing up once again. So Darwin's machine has lost its power. What you can do in your own family is to ask the following question, which works reasonably well for most people. How far apart was the birthplace of yourself and your partner, if you have one? How does that compare with the birthplace distance of your father and mother, your father's father and your father's mother, and so on? And almost invariably, that figure has gone up strikingly with time. Arguably the most important. In my case, the effect is extreme. My wife and I, who was born in New York, were born 3,000 miles apart. My mother and father were born 3 miles apart. And as my students often say, it shows. So I think we can really end up by saying that actually all we know about the Darwinian machine in terms of mutation, overwhelmingly in terms of natural selection, and pretty powerfully in terms of random change in small populations, they've lost their power. So I think the take-home lesson of my talk is, it may be a consolation to H.G. Wells, is that if you're worried about what utopia is going to be like, you shouldn't be, because you're living in it now. Thank you.
I suppose I should be encouraged that when tomorrow morning I reach for the Persil box, I'm reaching for a product of natural selection, having reflected over my muesli that I come from a long, long line of muesli eaters. Well, Professor Jones has given us the answer to his question. Mutation continues because we men are so error-prone. Natural selection does much less successfully, but the consolation came at the end that however brutish we think we are as good as we're going to get. Thank you very much indeed.